Welcome to the Troubleshooters podcast with me, your host, Mike McGrath. Well, season two of the Troubleshooters podcast is done and dusted, and what a pleasure it's been for me to interview all our guests. A big thank you to all of them. I also enjoy getting to hear their stories, and I hope you have too. Sit back and relax as we wrap up season two by pulling together some of the best bits and highlights. If something resonates, then the full episodes are on our website or wherever you like to listen to your podcasts. Enjoy. In our third episode of season two, we spoke to Kelly Jamieson, the co-founder and MD of Edible Blooms, an online gifting business that delivers delicious bouquets of chocolate, among other things, to homes and offices. I love listening to Kelly's journey, including her outlook on mistakes and how she learned from them. Enjoy this snippet of my conversation with Kelly, where we talk about some of her business decisions, as well as how she fosters a real culture of entrepreneurship throughout the business.
Oh, gosh. You know, I look now at what's available to startups. You know, they're you know, different channels for capital. And, you know, there's a lot of options for people starting up now that just didn't exist back in those early days. I remember I had one of the banks, oh, we love your idea. We'd love to chat to you about your business. But they said, oh, but you need 2 or 3 years of training. You know, we can't, you know, bank you until, you know, so in those very early days when you're really, you're pretty scrappy and, you know, you're really trying to make every dollar count, you know, that funding would be really helpful. But in some ways, I think, you know, sometimes when things are a little, when you've got a really tight budget, you make it go a long way. We didn't pay ourselves a lot in the early days either. That's the other thing. You compromise your own salaries and all of those sorts of things. But, you know, hopefully in the long term, it becomes worthwhile.
Yes. I mean, that's a very good point, is that whole, you know, they say necessity is a mother of invention. So,
Yeah, totally.
Having adequate capital is great. Having too much capital is not a great idea at all, because we generally will end up spending on the wrong things, because we're kind of, we don't know what we don't know, do we, in the beginning? And you've mentioned that in some of the stuff I've read, that you're very much were learning by mistakes, and you were using a feedback loop, and then you were making adjustments. And it's difficult to get those lessons if you've got plenty of capital to go and express yourself with.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it is an interesting challenge. But I do agree. I think you can have too much capital, and I think that's, you know, it can be detrimental because you can burn through cash very quickly.
And I love this quote where you say making mistakes is gold. What do you mean by that?
Well, we've had it in our company policy from the beginning, because I really wanted to try and foster a real culture of entrepreneurship through the business, because we were very scrappy when we were starting up, and I certainly learned that I wasn't perfect, and Abby learned the same as well. And so I think the key thing with mistakes is learning from them. So one of the things we like to do here is when we do make a mistake is we actually talk about it, and we talk about what we can learn. And sometimes making mistakes can actually be a good thing, because it means you're trying new things and you're not afraid to do something a little bit different. And look, one of the great examples is going back about 8 or 9 years ago, we were sending out our Christmas campaign to our corporate database. We do a lot of corporate gifting, and I think it was supposed to go out to a database of, you know, a few thousand people, one of our smaller databases. And we accidentally sent out the corporate email to our entire customer base. So this is like tens of thousands. So we had the most amazing sales period afterwards, because our customers who are consumer customers work in offices or work in businesses, and they saw our Christmas range. And so we got a lot of early corporate inquiry. So now every year since then, we send our corporate range to everybody. We say, this is what's available this year, because we do recognize that you might be a consumer customer of ours, but it doesn't mean that you can't be a business customer as well. So that's why I say mistakes are gold, because sometimes when you make a mistake, really good things can happen and you can learn some great things too. So it's not all about making a mistake and it being a bad thing.
Yeah, no, well, certainly we hear this a lot, that feedback loop that you get. You try something, you get some feedback, you adjust, you get some more feedback, you adjust again. And then isn't that the definition of continuous improvement, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it totally is. And you know, also we have to move very fast in today's business environment. You know, we don't have the time to perfect every single thing before it goes to market. So one of the things we've recently just innovated is we have a checkout option on our website called Instant Gift It. And it's a really great process because sometimes when you're sending a gift, we really analyze what are our friction points in the customer journey. And one of the friction points is people want to send something beautiful or congratulate somebody or say thank you for that referral. But you don't always know, especially now post-COVID, are they at home? Are they working in the office? What's the best address to send it to them? What's the best day of the week to send it to them? So we created a new checkout option, which we've got a trademark on the Instant Gifted. And it basically allows you to personalize the gift process by choosing. So I might say, oh, look, I know Mike loves chocolate dipped strawberries. I'm going to choose that box. And then I can write the gift card to you. And instead of having to then work out where you are and where it needs to go, I can send it to you by email, and then you can choose when you receive it and when it gets delivered. When we came up with that idea, the whole idea of perfecting everything, we had the process working perfectly, but we knew there were some extra bells and whistles we could add to it as we went. We said, let's get the basic service out, get some feedback, get the feedback loop. What are we missing? What do we need to add? And so actually one of the feedback loops that's come back is, gee, we love that, but we'd love to do that for our employees. We don't know everybody's home address now. So we want to send their Christmas gifts out by email, and then they can choose when they want to have it delivered and where. So, you know, so that's what we're working on at the moment for Christmas this year, so that we can actually do these bulk uploads and make it really easy for people to bulk send gifts. So there's some, you know, I think there's some real benefits in, you know, moving quickly, getting the prototypes up, and then, yeah, keeping that customer loop going to keep improving.
In episode 5, I spoke to Matt Stillown, founder and MD of Protein Supplies Australia, as well as a number of other successful companies. Matt founded Protein Supplies Australia in his home garage in 2011 with an initial investment of just $5,000. I chatted with Matt about how he overcame adversity, built strong resilience, and found what really matters in life. Have a listen to this snippet of our conversation where we chat about finding your purpose in life and the roller coaster ride of running a business.
Yeah, look, I am an unfiltered version of myself says, I think people are waking up in the sense of there's been a real, I guess, a trend which has been pushed by media that plant-based diets are the savior of these epidemics in our health sector, you know, obesity being one of them. And, you know, documentaries like Game Changers, I don't know if you're aware of that, you know, that really set off the trend, you know, and painting that whole thing. You can be really, really healthy and strong and fit and be plant-based, which, you know, necessarily can be true, but there's limitations, or you need to be really careful about your diet. And I think that with, like anything in this industry, trends. It's just trends. You know, keto, I've seen it all. You've seen it all too. Low fat's cool. Low sugar's cool. Now, next minute, fat's good again. You can eat as much fat as you want. Get on the keto diet. And then you've got, you know, this whole carnivore movement now. Everyone just live on meat, eat meat, day left, right and center. Mm. So I think it's like global trends and, you know, people realizing that it's not as sustainable as once was also, you know, sort of the propaganda around it.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I think you're right about trends. I think the other thing that we're seeing, particularly post-COVID, as we moved into those supply chain issues and a period of inflation with interest rates rising again, is that there's a premium to pay for genuinely. If you're talking about genuinely better for you with genuine integrity in the supply chain, there's normally a premium, Matt. And that premium is less attractive when you've got when there's a fiscal tightening on, which we've got at the moment, because people will trade down. And if you look at all the organic food sector over the last 30 years, each time it gets momentum, Matt, we get hit with a recession or some kind of issue, some kind of fiscal tightening once or twice a decade, and it goes back 2 or 3 years. And I think it's happening again now. I think that the research suggests that people will perhaps pay a 15% premium, but they won't pay a 25 or 30% premium. And that's kind of what we're facing. I mean, there's a certain genre of consumer that will, Matt, but they're not big enough to be mainstream.
Yeah, I would agree. Definitely.
Yeah. So, as you said, you've got to be smart. Well, look, most people, Matt, are having enough with one business, maybe two if they're nuts. You've got four here and you're still going, right? So, let me ask you this. What happened to that guy in his late teens and early 20s that was struggling with mental health issues and depression? Well, talk to me about how you manage that stress now and all the drama that goes with running four businesses. What's been the key, Matt?
That's a difficult one to answer without speaking too much on it. But I think for me, I found my purpose in life. Like, one, there's two things that really drive, three things actually, that really drive me to get out of bed in the morning. That sense of, like, and this is cliche, but sense of purpose, like feeling like I'm contributing something and I'm important in some way. And while I'm still here, people around me are benefiting from my existence. And that's a big driver for me of like getting out of bed in the morning.
Yes.
The next one is my son. So my son's now 19 in what, next week, week after. So, you know, that's obviously, you're a parent yourself, you'd know what it...
I've got five kids, yeah, so I know that, I know the story well, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and then lastly, like, I used to be very driven by money.
Okay.
You know, the more I got it, the more I wanted it, because I had never really had it a lot growing up like that. So, but then in the last few years, I've kind of come to terms with a lot of things about myself. I know myself so well now. And what I really realized that I actually genuinely love helping people and being a part of their journey to whatever success means for them. Those things, while I'm doing all those things, work doesn't, although it is extremely stressful, don't get me wrong, and you know, in particular right now, like obviously all these things going on with inflation and downturn with the economy and stuff, that's very difficult stuff to kind of go to bed at night and not worry about, especially when everything's on the line. But those sort of things for me, I think that while I feel that way, the stress, it feels like a game to me.
Okay.
Business is like an enjoyable game. I think like with anything in life, there's literally nothing that is worth having that isn't challenging. And like the journey, this, the whole process and all the stress and all the roller coaster of running businesses and things, I actually really enjoy it. And the journey is, it's the fun part about it. It's not the outcome, yeah, which some people measure by how many millions you have in your bank or what car you drive and stuff. That's the process, the journey. But I also do a lot of things, mate, like to manage this. So when I say that, you know, for any business owner out there, build a management team. Get people in your business that are actually smarter than you and know what they're talking about and teach you things and make yourself redundant. That was one thing. I tried to be an octopus for so long. And I definitely had some massive burnout situations where I really felt like I wanted to give up multiple times.
Yes, yes.
Finding balance is another cliche thing, but doing things that I enjoy, making sure that they're important, like, I respect them enough that I actually do them regardless of the workload that's on.
Yeah, that's great. No, you've come a long way, Matt, haven't you? No doubt. So just while we finish up, just talk to us about the three R's that you like.
Well, this has been a while since I did this, but resilience now stand out to me, and that's still the one of all of the, well, there's only three of them, but the three R's that I brought up, you know, a few years back. Resilience, it's something that you really can't teach, but it's something that you can learn by exposure. So when you're afraid to avoid certain situations that cause stress or their challenges, you know, a lot of people don't like waking up and not knowing what the day's going to bring. So that's why some people really enjoy working for someone else and being part of their vision. And and other business owners, entrepreneurs really get off on that idea as well. But I think building, exposing yourself to the most difficult and the most rewarding situations does give you thick skin and, you know, that determination and having that determination to keep going when a lot of people are willing to walk away and give up. And to me, what resilience is, resourcefulness as well. Like that's the other, one of the other R's that You know, I mentioned, you know, I'd said bootstrapping before. For me, I act like I, in a business, I always say to people, well, let's act like we have nothing. Like, what can we do with nothing? And how you become quite resourceful when you're really driven to make something happen. You know, that can mean leveraging off connections that you have. That can be working on your negotiation skills to be able to, again, wording, but convince someone to maybe invest in your vision as well. Yeah, being resourceful and you know, investing in yourself as well. That's
in some ways, it's that creativity, that problem solving. You alluded to it. It's that, you know, there's an old saying that says necessity is a mother of invention. And in a way, if you have to, then you will. And you know, so that, yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I think that resilience, which we also think of here as persistence, resourcefulness is about solving problems by being creative and not getting lost in the negativity of a problem, right?
Yes.
Because we're going to get walloped by them regularly. So just pausing and having a listen to yourself and then framing up. Often we find that the seed of the solution is embedded in the problem somewhere. And if you can be objective enough about looking at the problem, maybe from a different angle, often you can find some great lessons in there. And then the last one you mentioned was relationships.
Everyone in my business, they're like family to me. And truly, because you spend more time with them than you do your own family at times in your life, which is kind of sad in itself, but it's true. So, you know, building relationships, lasting relationships is really, for me, such a rewarding. It's like planting a seed and then seeing the fruit come 10 years later, because those relationships that you had at the bottom, or when you're trying to build something great and you have a whole bunch of people trying to help you, they might move on to bigger and better things. Maybe some point, and even down to like suppliers and all these sort of things, some point in your business career, that relationship might be the one that saves you. Yeah. And when I say that, you never know who you're talking to. You really never know. And the perfect stranger can come along and drop this one little dime of something that will just change your whole trajectory in life. So for me, relationships and building relationships is where I am successful because of that skill set I have as well.
I love my chat with Tom Waterhouse, the founder of Waterhouse VC. Tom, hailing from the illustrious Waterhouse family, started his career in bookmaking at the young age of just 18 and quickly rose to become Australia's top on-course bookmaker. His journey is a testament to the power of mentorship, adaptability, and sheer innovation. Have a listen to how Tom reflects on the mentors in his life and his journey from handling millions on Derby Day to pioneering online bookmaking. I know originally you were thinking about finance, but you, the story goes that you got to the track and within 20 minutes you'd realised you wanted to do it.
Yeah, look, I still finished. I did commerce degree at Sydney Uni and majored in finance, and I loved doing that, but the racing industry and bookmaking, there was just so much money there back then, 20 something years ago, and it was just full of energy and excitement. And also I had a big advantage in that my grandfather was biggest bookie in the world in the 60s and 70s. And my dad, he ran a professional betting syndicate since 1980 and was a leading bookmaker. So I had a blueprint of what to do. And you're very lucky when you're young and you have a mentor or a couple of mentors that can say, look, this is how you do it, because then it's easy. You just follow what they say.
It's a great point that. And actually, I was going to ask you, what was it like to have famous parents and a famous grandparent like that? Well, you know, was it all advantage or was there some disadvantages to that?
You don't even think about it because that's what all you know. But now looking back on it, I think what an advantage. You know, like what an amazing thing to be able to go into an industry that they have such a good understanding of, such an exciting industry. Yeah, it's a huge, like I've been blessed, you know, in terms of, and there's always like slight disadvantages to your advantages, but there's not for one second that I don't think how lucky I was, you know.
Excellent. And look, just on that point then, I mean, we're not talking just about you becoming a licensed bookmaker at age 20. We're talking about you then became, by age 28, the largest and most profitable on-course bookie in Australia. I mean, that's phenomenal rise, really.
Yeah, look, there were a lot of things, but there were probably three main things. Obviously, my grandfather was, I had him as a mentor, and we went in a partnership when I was like 22 or something like that. So I had great learning from him. And then my dad was a form genius. So he had this amazing like form database. So I had his form and all the learnings. I never stopped asking my dad. I still don't stop asking him questions. How do I do this? What should I do here? And then also the internet took off and I moved to Melbourne where you could offer different products than what you could in New South Wales. And I had the advantage of being able to access Betfair and see what the market was doing. It's like having access to the ticker on the stock market.
Yeah.
And a lot of the bookies hadn't picked up having a computer and stuff. So yeah. I had big advantages and also the name, the brand, the family.
Yeah.
I thought I was going to be doing that the rest of my life. And it was a highly profitable, large business. But everything changed in 2008, 2009 with a change of regulation.
Yeah. And then you had to pivot. Massively.
Had to pivot, yeah, because we were turning over, I think I held $6 million on Derby Day in 2008.
My goodness.
And like the favourite in the Derby would have got $500,000 in cash out of it as standing it. And the next year was lucky to get $5,000 out of it. And I thought, well, the game's up. I have to move online.
Okay.
And so, yeah, we launched TomWaterhouse.com in 2009, proper launch in 2010. And within 18 months, we had 250,000 customers, which was just... Yeah, phenomenal growth. But to put it in perspective, I turned over more as an on-course bookie in 2008 than TomWaterhouse.com turned over as an online bookie before we sold.
Yeah, okay.
So on-course bookmaking was a big business.
Yeah.
Which is easy to forget because when you go to the races now, there's no one there.
No.
But it's only 15, 20 years ago that it was all there.
And founding TomWaterhouse.com, right, that movement online, you were having to figure a lot of that out yourself, I presume. I mean, it's effectively a digital revolution.
Yeah, it was. It was an amazing learning experience because I barely used email back in 2008.
Right.
I know that, and that sounds so foreign now, but I barely used email. Yeah. iPhone only came out in 2008.
That's right.
But you know, so I think I had a Nokia before then or something like that. And so we shifted to online and it was a big change. But you really look at what mentors and what's going well, and a few of the other bookies had moved online and their businesses were booming.
Yeah.
So the likes of Sporting Bet, Sports Bet, Cole Tidy, Alan Iskander in Melbourne, they were all moving online. And so you could go, well, what are they doing? That looks like it's pretty good. How do I sort of use that as a blueprint to copy and to basically go in that space and then find your own little path within it? That was a huge learning experience. And there was so much we didn't know, so many mistakes we made, but those mistakes and learning it ultimately led to us selling to William Hill and then running William Hill's business in Australia.
In episode 10, I sat down with Tom Hardwick. Tom is an experienced CEO and entrepreneur. He has demonstrated a history of scaling businesses, both organically and through acquisitions. His journey from co-founding a leading Australian childcare group to launching a European-inspired wine bar is nothing short of impressive. With experience spanning sectors from childcare to private equity and now into hospitality, Tom's entrepreneurial spirit knows no bounds.
So yeah, we did 2 years at BBY and we just weren't sort of loving the environment there. So the team moved across to Paterson Ordmanet and that had its own challenges working for a Perth-based group in Sydney. But what I did is I built the foundations at BBY and then when I went to Paterson's, I just had this sweet spot of, and I'd sort of focused on income style products, primarily listed property trusts, the smaller property trusts that the big banks didn't really pay a lot of attention to. And so probably raised $400 or $500 million over 3 years at Paterson's, whether from IPOs or placements, etc. And so I built a bit of a franchise in the small property trust space. And then a couple of the big banks noticed it and said, hey, why don't you come and join us? And it was sort of tempting to go into the big investment bank space, but I'm not someone for all that corporate politics and the big, and I had it at Coors. And so I went and, you know, spoke to one of my mentors at the time, Frank Wolf, who was running Abacus, or he founded Abacus, and said, Frank, look, I'm at this crossroads. Here's where I am. He says, Tom, why don't you come and work for us? You'd be great, sort of looking after our funds management business and investor relations. And, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, the great jobs you get in your life, you don't normally apply to an ad or a recruiter. You sort of, it's through your networks and, you know, discussions. And so out of that, you know, I went and joined Abacus. And, you know, it was a great 2 years pre-GFC, you know, building their funds platform and, you know, buying some assets and syndicating it.
Because, again, there was a movement, was a bubble.
Yeah,
We didn't know it was a bubble. But, but there was, you know, I remember the guys in London, Oasis, were saying selling a business is like shooting fish in a barrel.
And
then, boy, did it change.
Yeah.
And it's never gone back, actually.
No, it was interesting. So we went to Macquarie had this global roadshow. So you went to London for a few days and then New York for a few, and they got all these investors to hear the stories of these Australian property trusts. And when we were there, a few people in London were saying, oh, are you no, in the US, they were saying, oh, are you having trouble accessing debt yet? And I said, no, what are you talking about? It's all fine in Australia. And they were just seeing the start of the, you know, the crash. And then, you know, a couple of months later, Centro couldn't get its debt refinanced in the US and bang, it just world changed pretty quick.
No, didn't it happen quick?
Yeah, it did. That was probably one of the scarier times being in a business that big with, you know, we had $2 billion of assets and going, geez, where's the cash gone? And, you know, the banks want us to delever and, you know, that was pretty hairy.
So who were the guys in investment banking that were helping you? Like, was it sink or swim? Or in fact, you know, were you taken under anybody's wing?
It was so tough. The investment banks were, you know, they were really focusing on the big guys. Frank basically got an introduction to a very wealthy man in South Africa, left Australia on Christmas Eve, went and spent Christmas Day with him in South Africa, and within 24 hours basically negotiated an underwritten rights issue to, you know, restore Abacus's balance sheet. And, you know, basically Frank and Natey did it themselves, and then they bought in one of the investment banks to wrap it up a little bit.
Right.
But no, it was Frank. Okay. Frank had to go and save his company, and, you know, it was a public company with a board, and you know, so the little guys were the last to get any love. But, you know, he got off his backside and he solved the problem.
And yes, look, that was a unique time in finance. I mean, what was emerging of private equity, which wasn't a lot in Australia at that point, it was very small. That just disappeared overnight. They kind of ran for the hills.
Yeah.
Banks started to get out of the investments they'd made. And funnily enough, we just started in Australia at that point.
Yeah, okay.
So, you know, we had 2 years of nothing.
Yeah.
And so we had to get fairly creative, trust me. So that's interesting. You enjoyed that time in investment banking.
Yep.
You were with Abacus and so you'd been in there for best part of a decade.
Yeah.
One way or the other.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah. 5 or 6 years investment banking, four years at Abacus, yeah.
And then you'd had maybe the best part of 8 or 9 years in law.
Yep.
So at that stage we've got a, you know, some skills emerging, haven't we?
Yeah, and it was, I think when I look back at the success of Guardian, it was this sort of breadth of experiences over 20 years that I felt gave me a very good platform to be a CEO. But it did take a bit of courage, right? Because every 3 or 4 years I'd get a bit bored and I tended to jump into things that were quite new. And, you know, so there's, I remember talking to Greg Paramore, who was one of the great property REIT, you know, CEOs. And he said, listen, son, just back yourself. You know, if you think it's a good thing, jump off the deep end and have a crack at it. And what's the worst thing that can happen? It doesn't work. And like with the logistics business, right? I jumped out of a partnership in a law firm. It failed, but, you know, it was a good experience. And without that, I wouldn't have got the next opportunity.
So on that point then, so you kind of, when did you decide that you'd had enough at Abacus?
What had happened was we had started building Guardian as a bit of a side project. You know, my wife was in childcare her whole life.
Right.
When we came back from America, we bought our first centre in Narre Warren in Melbourne.
So for those who don't know, and we've got a few international listeners, they might not know who Guardian is. Yes. So for those two listeners, tell us what Guardian is.
Sure. So Guardian Early Learning Group was a childcare business that we built, basically started from scratch in about 2004, that, you know, I eventually joined full-time in 2010 from Abacus into that, and there's, you know, I'll tell you that story. And then over those years from 2010, we essentially, up until 2010, we managed other people's assets for a fee. In 2010, we raised private equity to buy some assets that Abacus had put together.
In episode 13, I sat down with Tim Hutchinson, co-founder and CEO of SkillsGPT. AI is currently being talked about extensively. Many of us are bemused by what it all means. I spoke to Tim about his journey from zoology to the world of AI. Quite a jump. Tim now helps companies tap into the power of AI to better manage their workforce. Highlighting real-world applications in sectors such as energy, he emphasizes the need for continuous learning and collaboration between developers and business owners. Here's a preview of our conversation where we explore some of the disruptions Tim is seeing with the emergence of AI.
Well, let me give you an example then, which is probably a, not probably, would be a combination of those two broad sources of data you touch on. A lot of our work as SkillsGPT is really trying to find opportunity and disruption for organizations, particularly around their workforce. Now, what I mean by that is we've got some fairly massive disruptions happening. They are macro disruptions. So AI, the emergence of AI, of course, people are concerned about what that means to jobs. Mm.
So give an example of some of the disruptions that you're seeing.
I'll give you an example from a conversation yesterday where, you know, a client in the energy sector, because a lot of our work is moving to sectors such as under transition. So the transition to clean energy from legacy sources is a brilliant example of workforce disruption.
Okay.
Because you've got fundamentally, you've got legacy jobs rolling off in simple terms from, you know, the coal, gas industries.
Yeah.
And you've got an increasing demand for people with knowledge and skills around renewables.
Okay.
You know, making connections to solar, to wind, et cetera.
So that's binary, really. You're not talking, I mean, the disruption there is you're not switching a workforce. It's a new workforce and a new...
So that's a big external disruption happening. From a tech perspective, so sorry, I was going to explain even in that instance, so there's that sort of macro disruption.
Yeah.
And then so there are challenges there in terms of finding the right staff. They don't actually exist at scale with those renewables experience.
Okay.
So they're starting to look at efficiencies in the existing workforce as a starting point.
Yeah.
Even if you can find 1 or 2% efficiencies, it all helps.
Okay.
So, you know, at one point in time recently, they're looking for more people with scheduling, rostering, planning experience.
Yeah.
But 2 or 3 months down the track, recognize that some of the AI tools are able to perform that task.
Right.
So as opposed to needing people with rostering experience,
right,
you pivot, and what you actually need is people with the ability to right size those AI rostering models.
Right.
So that and this
and they're different kinds of people. So they're used talking about technical people versus, you know, project management type people.
In simple terms, and this is where you start to think, well, what actually is, where does knowledge fit for people? Is it functional knowledge? Is it technical knowledge?
Yeah.
And there is no answer to it because this is a rapidly moving piece. We're not building product at this stage.
No.
We're not building out of the box SaaS product because in most cases we're trying to find a highly effective point solution for a priority problem around workforce and then to develop from there.
Mm. Look, I mean, I suppose the real challenge is that, most of the probably listeners to this podcast are small business owners, right? About 40% of them are apparently. So there's, you know, hundreds of small businesses that are going, you know, they hear AI, they get the Fin Review, you know, they read articles like, will AI be a bust?
And surely not the binary right. press.
And so we're looking at, okay,
how do I harness this? What's in it for me? Because, you know, you think about Woolworths or Coles and all their data and you go, okay, well, you know, you can play the long game. You can, you can invest in this. There's such a business case there. I mean, you can already see from the amount of data they must have. If you could start to do something with that dynamically and get insights and
the proven ROI is already massive.
Yeah, so it's off the chart.
Yes.
But was it, you know, your small business, they employ 50 people and they're trying to think through, okay, well, how do we harness this thing? Other than we've got ChatGPT on the desk and or Microsoft Copilot and we're just plugging in questions.
Yeah, well, yeah. But even that actually, I mean, even that part. So, you know, if you think about ChatGPT, and I'm sure listeners are using it for various tasks at home and, dare I say, at work, but with the security concerns. Very quickly, small organizations started to get their own sort of secure instance through 365, so they therefore can have that conversation with ChatGPT securely. And it's a good point, because actually organizations, you start to, the people who efficiently are finding good use for it are the workers. If you actually ask people what they're using it for, and have an open, honest conversation, that's where you learn the insights. And people will be using it for report writing. They'll be using it for structuring reports. They'll be using it for planning their week. Every possible sort of entry-level use, if you like. But I think what's happened is, I think you mentioned the newspaper there. You know, we have this strange binary press where you have to go through a hype cycle, don't you, where first of all, it's incredible. It's going to solve all the problems in the world. And then a week later, it's going to be the end of all work.
Yeah, all jobs are gone.
At least you just have to let that pass. And then, you know, now we're at a stage where companies are trying to, or beginning to understand what's possible.
Yeah.
And trying to find these practical solutions. However, you know, there is, I mentioned cost earlier, and actually for SMEs, there is a cost factor.
Yeah.
And in many cases you know, to have a, we get a lot of requests from people who, I'll think of one very close to home the other week, a recruitment company who said to us, hey, we've of course got a CRM with 100,000 candidates on it. Could we, you know, put that in their terminology, put that into AI and find interesting things?
Right.
Now, the answer is yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Does it come at a cost? Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And because of this pace of change in the world, you can't in good conscience stitch somebody a solution together and leave it with them.
No.
You actually need to then sort of offer a managed service to continually help that model develop.
Because it's a continuous improvement thing.
You know, there is a difference between... so I'd say two things broadly, and they're objective, hopefully, and not in any selfish interest. One is with AI, the best thing to do is to get started. Now, by that, let me clarify. I don't mean get started, start throwing money at the problem. I mean start learning about it, start reading about it, start trying to at least understand what it is. If anyone wanted to reach out on LinkedIn afterwards, we've got various resources that point to, you know, a nice checklist of 20 resources they can go to for free to start that learning journey.
Yeah,
because I think you need to understand it first of all.
Yeah,
you know, and then the other piece is probably to talk to existing staff, because people will be using ChatGPT, and rather than pretending they're not from a security perspective.
So tell me about the security risk, right? So, you know, someone in a small business, say there's 20 staff, and half a dozen of them start, you know, they're using ChatGPT, and they haven't told anyone. So where are the risks for the business there?
Well, I think, I mean, the risk is that you are essentially sharing information publicly. So I remember quite early on we had, and it feels like a lifetime ago, but it was a year ago, a CFO was stood up in a meeting we were in and sort of laughing about it, said, oh, I've uploaded the annual accounts and I've started to get some insights.
Okay.
It's really, really not a good idea.
Wow.
Now, generative AI ChatGPT is not a search engine.
No.
So as such, that packet of information, that set of accounts isn't sitting there to be accessed in its entirety.
Oh, okay.
However, it's something of an unknown as to what aspects are. So absolutely you shouldn't be sharing sensitive information. But as we all know, straight censorship is not an answer to anything. So I think you need a discussion with staff and really understand. Because that's, again, going to that point about it originates in the boardroom, not the server room. Take the workforce as a proxy for the boardroom. Find out what people are using it for. Find out where the efficiencies are. And the other thing I'd say, I quite like this, is I've got a colleague, Ray Fleming, who tries to explain generative AI in simple terms and says, treat it as an intern. Okay. I quite like it because if you think about an intern, you get the best out of them by giving them the best direction, simple, structured direction. You find value in the work typically quickly, but you typically or should check the work. And that's very much the same with generative AI. You know, there are phenomenal insights, but I think you do have to also take it with a pinch of salt because of hallucinations people will have heard of, and make certain that you're either applying your own critical thinking, or the guys who've built the models for you have thought about what, how the information that's surfaced is verified and against what.
Well, there you have it. I hope you've enjoyed season two and this little wrap up. Thanks to you, our listeners, who've been with us since day one. And if it's your first time here, you're very welcome. Hit subscribe and look out for season three as we bring you another round of genuine business troubleshooters to inspire and motivate you to keep going even when the going gets tough. Don't forget to subscribe. And if you enjoyed any episode, leave us a review. Thanks for being here. Until next time.